You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I think that's what's exciting is that it and it was the promise that we made. I feel like I don't know if I made a different promise than other people, but the way I took it was we were going to promise to not be sellouts and we were going to do the right thing. And we were not going to become numb. We were not going to become assimilated into the capitalist system that wanted us to just be robots. And I feel like pretty much all my friends did that. And then now they're out there in the world, like with kids or with, doing all different kinds of activisms or art. And like, I just hope that I'm continuing that as well. You know, I hope to be able to act in a bunch of different stuff now that the world's less transphobic.
Sure.
In some ways, we were waiting, us 90s queer people. We would never have imagined this moment. But when we were making up pronouns, like, what should we do? Like, Zeezer? You know, we never thought that it would be legitimate in the mainstream.
I'll go the long way. I'll take my time. I know someday I realize it might take me my whole life, but at least I did it right. I did it right.
Hello and welcome to the Adulting Well podcast. I am your co-host Pepper, and I am joined as always by the hardest working man in show business, Kevin McCracken. Who's with us today, Kevin?
Well, today we have Daniel C, and I am I am very, very excited to have you on the show, Daniel. I had been texting with your good friend Miriam here in California.
Miriam, who was on the show?
Yes, Miriam Stahl. Oh. And I don't know if you remember this, but we met at the Jawbreaker show at Gilman.
Okay, you did seem familiar.
Right, yeah. In front of the merch table, and I was doing merch for them that night. And
oh, that's right. You were doing merch. I was considering buying one of those Morton Salt shirts.
Well, we'll have to send you one.
The Jawbreaker Classic.
Yep.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we can jump right in. You sent me a great bio, and, you know, I'm really glad you did, because obviously the stuff online tends to be a little bit, you know, not totally complete, but
I mean, really, Kevin, it's missing the most important thing in the whole world, which is that basement in Santa Rosa where I saw Thorns of Light. Which is all that matters to me.
So
you were there, that tiny basement? That's like the biggest fire hazard of my life.
It was crazy. Yeah. It was unreal.
That's one of my favorite shows I ever played, actually. I love
that. Oh, me too.
Yeah,
that's
so
awesome.
That was good. Thanks for listening, everybody.
So Daniel, talk a little bit about your early punk days. We love to hear sort of the backstory of how people got involved in punk so that we can then talk about how it influences your life today. But
even like when you were a kid, because I'm sure like you had weirdo tendencies pre-punk, right?
Yeah. I mean, my parents were eccentric artists and my dad's queer, and so I definitely grew up with all of the great like 60s and this perspective on music being like a revolutionary act. I mean, I think that probably the first punk I heard, I was pretty little, cause I was born in 73. So I know my parents went to see the Sex Pistols in 77 or 78, I guess, in Hollywood.
Where were you?
I lived on the West Side in LA, like Santa Monica area, kind of. Sure. at that time. And so, yeah. And then into my teen years, you know, my brother was into punk and was going down to Fenders and stuff, but I was a bit young for that. So it was probably like the easy entry was the Violent Femmes. You know, that was my first like introduction slowly into my take on punk. And then, you know, and then it was, yeah, the Subhumans, UK version of Subhumans. And then, of course, the LA bands, Circle Jerks, Bad Religion. Those were the first show I went to was Circle Jerks and Bad Religion and Reseda at the Country Club.
So did you want to play in LA bands shows. When you saw bands?
I did, because I played music. You know, I played guitar, but you know, I didn't. I played with my brother. We played at home, you know, and stuff. And we had a couple songs. Like we had a song about Denny's that we wrote. It was the first punk song I wrote. It was about Denny's, drinking coffee all night at Denny's, which is about all there was to do in LA. For young people. But I soon moved up to the Bay when I turned almost 17. And mm-hmm. then that's when I met Anna Brown, who's her, she's a punk rocker and is in charge of Murray Bowles archive at this point, and an educator and a very cool person. And she was a year older than me. And our dads had been friends, my stepdad and her dad. And so I asked her, hey, where's the punk shows? Because I couldn't figure out where to find the shows because they weren't listed in the, like in LA, I would look in the LA Weekly or something, but right, they weren't listed right. in the paper. And she's like, you got to come to Gilman. So it took me some months to find the punk shows. But thanks to Anna Joy. I mean, Anna Brown, I did find Gilman.
Amazing. Yeah. I want to just roll back a little bit because my wife, her dad and mom are both queer, and she grew up, she's a little bit younger than us. You and I are about the same age. What was it like in LA at that time as a child of like queer parents? Because I know she struggled even in so-called liberal Marin County a little bit.
Yeah, it was tough. I got the message early on to like not tell people in my class, but that didn't go well because I'm like, you know, not the type that can hide stuff. You know, as kids, you can't.
Yeah.
Just because it would be hard for me. I mean, I was dealing with my own bullying stuff, so I think it was last on people's list. But I think it added to the atmosphere of the weirdo-ness of my family, including like being like Wiccan people who would like, you know, celebrate pagan holidays. And my parents were very radical at that time. I guess my first experience with it was great because I was 4 years old, 3 and 4 years old. And my dad's boyfriend lived with us with my mom. And for me, for kids, the more love, the better. So my dad's boyfriend at the time, Manuel, was living with us. And it was like one big family to me. And then when my dad had his longtime partner, who I would call his ex-husband, they were together for 20 years. That was a very happy family experience. They had a house in Tujunga with a pool. They both worked at Disney in the Imagineering. And we just had a great time. Tom was like halfway between us and my dad's age. So he was 23 and my dad was 32. And my brother was like 9 and I was 5. So all those years were great, you know, I mean, and yeah. So, but at school, you know, generally at 80s LA, was very in the West Side, white suburb, kind of segregated, formulated whiteness of the suburbs was pretty heavy. You know, I mean, I had my friends and my cousins and my family, but it was pretty right wing. I would say like you could feel the Reagan-ness and the kind of assimilation politics, like the backlash against the radical 60s, which now we know was like a, you know, an operative thing from the CIA and everything to kind of create that atmosphere. But from my side, it was just like, wow, you know, you had to really try to be normal. And so that's
the culture wars are very old.
Yeah. That's where punk came in, because it's just answered the questions like, oh, I'm like this. I want a different way of life and it's possible. And, you know, it also answered the question of a bit of rebellion against what my parents were into.
Right. Because what can you do?
We thought was so different, but it wasn't actually that different.
Well, you grew up in what feels like an artist incubation chamber. And I feel like you grew up with a lot of things that were normalized that are only slowly kind of starting to kind of get normalized now, right? A little bit.
Yeah.
As far as like queerness and stuff like that. So I guess I should have thought about this before, but I hadn't. As a straight white guy in the suburbs, I had to like I had to break down how I actually felt, right? Like I had to break down not being uncomfortable and break down like where all that comes from. So for your perspective, are you just watching the world going like, like, are you just waiting for the world as a young person to catch up? I mean, it's just a different experience. Like, I had to train myself, and you already were there, right? You already were.
Well, we're all in it anyway. So all the kind of self-doubt and the questioning, am I crazy? That was a big theme, which I love the Suicidal Tendencies song, Institutionalized. It answers that question. Like, because a lot of the time I still felt like, well, maybe I'm the crazy one. I mean, and that's like a thing that took a long time to work out. And I only was worked out in community. And I must give props to my brother, because he really was also always questioning everything and was really always encouraging. And we went on the punk journey together all the way into squatting in Europe and living collectively, everything. So luckily I had a great older brother that was interested in things outside of the 80s norm of LA.
That's amazing. So let's pick up at you got to Berkeley and started going to Gilman. And Gilman at that time was just such a unique occurrence in
was
the country.
Was that 87, 88? What time were we talking about?
Probably, no,
it was early 90s, right?
1990, I would have gone. Or maybe it was early 91 when I first went.
Oh, that's the perfect time. That's right when I started going.
Yeah.
Pepper. So you that's when you really started to get involved in actually playing music, though.
Yeah, you know, actually was a really interesting experience, because, I mean, I was playing music all along, but I wasn't in a band or anything. And then it's a kind of iconic thing, but basically Bikini Kill came and played, I think it was their first show at Gilman. They opened for Tribe Aid and Nation of Ulysses. And Kathleen called any girls in the audience. She said, I guess I was 17 at that point. Is there any girls in the audience who play instruments? Meet me out the side door. So I went out that side door, which later was is another moment in my life when I auditioned for my first band, waiting at that side door. But she took all of our addresses, and I think there was probably, you know, 8 of us out there. And then I don't know how many, but a few. And then I got a package in the mail about 6 weeks later, stacked with Riot Girl fanzines, a spoken word album of hers, and their demo tape. And of course, the fanzines introduced me to queer theory, feminist theory stuff, stuff about being survivor of abuse, and then also the importance of like playing in bands. So I was very overwhelmed, because I was living with my boyfriend at the time, and I was like, I didn't know how to respond, so I never wrote back. I got another letter in the mail, probably 6 weeks again later, like, hey, did you get that package? Have you started a band? Like, really encouraging. And I didn't know if she would even remember me. It was definitely just like
I didn't realize she was that proactive in
creating. She really was. And I mean, I still have that second letter, like, hey, I hope you're playing music. Did you get that package I sent you?
That's above board.
Above board, like real. And so, you know, thanks to that, and then also just going to Gilman and starting to hang around with people, I found out about this Grupps audition from Jesse, because at that time Jesse Luscious became a friend of mine as I was hanging out in the scene. He said, hey, we're looking for a guitarist to replace Matt at the time, who was just focusing on Rancid. And so I went and auditioned. I waited outside that same side door on a Sunday.
Wait, Matt was the original? No, I didn't.
Yeah, Matt, and then Deb was a bassist. I forget her last name. I'm so bad with names. But anyway, Matt and Deb were the bassist and guitarist. They were looking for a new bassist and guitarist. So I waited outside that same side door. I was so nervous. This guy was shredding in there. He's like doing some kind of crazy solos. And actually, my friend Bill, who I think he played in one of these Bay Area bands. Oh, my brain is a little bit slow right now with the band names. But anyway, he played in one of the older Bay Area bands, and he showed me some rockabilly licks, and I just studied for like a week, and then I showed up in there, I learned the songs, and then I played and I got in. So that's how I ended up going on tour and getting to like tour US and Europe and stuff. And that was really awesome.
Your first tour experience like?
Well, my first tour experience, we toured the US, and we were kind of like paralleling with Jawbreaker, who were also friends of mine at that time. And so sometimes we'd be in the same town, they'd be playing a bigger show, we'd play in smaller, and then we'd meet up. Or there were other bands like on tour at the same time, in the whole network of it. We didn't go all the way to the East Coast. We went up the Midwest, like up through Chicago, up to like Minot. We played in Minot, North Dakota. We played in a lot of great small towns, garages, clubs, you know, wherever we could.
I did a similar tour around that time. We cut through and went up to like St. Louis and, you know, did those like smaller kind of suburb areas.
What band were you in, Kevin?
At that time I was in Engage. So I don't know if you remember Miriam and Brian Zero. But Miriam worked an episode.
Yeah, Miriam was a friend of mine. Yeah.
Yeah. Brian. So she was like our manager basically for Siren, because we would spend so much time arguing. She would have to be like the mediator of the band. But
Miriam, what a special person in this world. Yeah. I'm so glad I got to meet her. I met her at a animal rights protest the first time I met her.
Oh, really?
In Berkeley, we were protesting outside of the science labs there.
I have the photo of Brian getting choked at that. I was there.
Yeah, Lou's been like 90 or 91, right?
Did you say Brian Zero getting choked?
Yeah, by a Berkeley police
officer. It got heavy.
It got really heavy.
Remember the science people were laughing at us and stuff and pointing down from the balcony?
Yeah, they thought it was really funny when the cops pepper sprayed a few of us. They were laughing and, they abused Brian pretty badly that day, actually.
Mm-hmm. I never heard about that.
Choked him. It was really heavy.
Hit his knuckles with like their batons to get him off the chain link fence. Yeah, it was heavy. But that's that family like brought me into a lot of my activism personally as well, especially around animal rights. So there's another connection. But what a fun time to be touring the U.S. There was like that was when like the first edition of Book Your Own Fucking Life was coming out, and people were sharing all the contacts and like.
Well, she was already like the booker extraordinaire. She had booked all these bands like ever since the 80s. Like I think she booked when Miriam was in high school, and they had Operation Ivy come in. My best friend Miriam that we were talking about before. Yeah. I think that she was the one booking them. Or maybe it was Crimshrine. I don't know. I get my things.
Crimshrine is funnier.
But Kamala did our, you know, she was our drummer. So she booked Kamala from Kamala and Carnivores. She booked our everything and arranged everything, which was great because I was still pretty spaced out. I was 18 at that point or 19 and didn't have my stuff so together, but I just had to show up and play. And it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And then I got to go to Europe, you know, and experienced all of the squatting and like these huge squats that were going on at that time. All this, it was like a Pippi Longstocking dream or something. You'd be like, I can't believe this. Look at what they have.
It feels so immersive.
A
lot of people aren't all in like that. Like for me, instance, like I would be halfway into some sort of stable thing and halfway into some sort of art thing. But it sounds like you're just free falling through.
It was a great opportunity. It's true. And we opened we were on tour with Citizen Fish. So they already had like built in audiences. And so then we could just be with them on a lot of our tours and in Europe and stuff. So we made a lot of friends. And my brother was our roadie. So then he ended up staying in Europe. He's lived here since then, basically.
What a great band to have sort of steward the tour too, because they were always so supportive of like younger and smaller bands. Yeah. They always wanted local openers on all their shows when they came to the US, and just like a really serious, like the DIY ethic ran so deep with them. What a great experience. Like the thing that came to mind when you were talking about that was the absence of screens and social media on these tours. It was like basically you were like either going to go out during the day and go to bookstores and record stores and cafes, or you're with your bandmates. And that was really you couldn't sit around and doom scroll. You know what I mean?
You couldn't call anyone, really. No. I mean, sometimes we could collect call, but...
Yeah, but like if you were out in the middle of nowhere, the chances of even having enough money on a phone card or whatever to call somebody were so rare, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's this kind of togetherness that I still really treasure to just be on the road in that kind of situation, you know, with just a map, nothing online, nothing, you know, and just you have the number of someone. They said you could show up at their thing. It took a lot of like trust, you know, and that's the thing I think we had in our larger. I mean, not that everything was perfect, but there was definitely a lot of like fellowship and trust and kind of working together to make these kind of things that seemed impossible to happen, like putting out records or
it's unreal.
And like, and encouragement, you know, that's something that I always go back to and I go, wow, you know, there were just people like that Kathleen moment. I mean, it's iconic and everything, and it was her. But I mean, she was doing something special. But it was the same as Bill needing me to teach me the guitar right. licks, or Jasper making a video for us from Citizen Fish making a video for us, or, you know, just helping each other out for the good of it, for the love of it all. And I just, for me, it's like I think it's the most precious thing. I just feel so lucky that I stumbled upon this thing, you know?
The scene is kind of that scene is, you know, I can't imagine another time or place in which one could like me and my friend could just go hitchhiking and take Book Your Own Fucking Life with us and have places to stay. Right.
Yeah.
Call the punk house. Hey, I'm in town. They're like, oh, cool. Punk, come over and stay here. That's magical. Like, I don't know if that exists now. I hope it does in some form.
Well, I will say, like, on the side of now, the kids that are kind of running Gilman now, and I say kids because they're just so much younger than me, they could literally probably be my children, some of them, are really amazing. You know, I mean, the whole lineup before that Jawbreaker show was all local, like younger people. And one of them is one of the bookers at Gilman. And he's just like a steadfast, he respects the history of the place, but also is like, we're doing our own thing too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's just so amazing to watch that, like, that sort of like, okay, we loved what you guys did, but this is, you know, we're playing our music too. And like the fact that Jawbreaker was like, book whatever local bands you think are the best fit. Like, what a great to come back and play a show at Gilman for the first time in 25 years.
Gilman continues, and like for Miriam's students there in Berkeley, like they volunteer there. It's like, for me, punk has always been an intergenerational thing, and it goes in every direction. And I just like, I feel like the young, I know it's hard to manage all the screen stuff and everything, but I feel like the people younger than me are showing up in a great way for punk, for queer stuff, and for like radical community. That also impresses me, you know?
I agree. Let's actually delve into that a little bit, because the time that you were in SF and Berkeley early on was like a pivotal moment in the queer community. I mean, we literally, like, as a region in the country, we lost almost an entire generation of men during that time of gay, you know, queer men, and including my wife's father who passed away of AIDS. You know, and I think that I hear ripples about it in sort of in my, you know, in my regular life. But I mean, I don't know how much that gets acknowledged as a whole in sort of the mainstream of America. And so we've got a whole generation of queer men that were lost to AIDS. Then we've got the one behind them that didn't have that mentorship coming up, you know, of like, you know, and so what you did, I know you did a lot of activism and continue to do. What was that like to be here in the 90s and having like ACT UP out there? And, you know, I mean, all the stuff that was going on, it was a pretty intense time.
It was intense times. You know, you grow up in intense time. You think, oh, this is just life. But when I look back, I go, wow, you know, when they say now is intense times, I go, well, you know, when we moved over to San Francisco, Anna Joy, our singer, was already living over there. And so then I ended up with my roommate, Ula McKnight, moving over there. So I could be around more of the queer. I mean, there were queer people at Gilman, but it was a lot of my friends were pretty straight and sometimes we just needed space to be together with the other queer punks and do our thing. So luckily there was Epicenter and there was Q-Tip, Queers Together in Punkness, which is a collective running out of there. And they put on shows at Epicenter. Starting, I think, in 94, 95, Miriam was a big part of that, and Araya Robles and a bunch of people. So to be able to be there at that time, it was like at the same time, a lot of celebration and discovery of ourselves and getting to chance to play and try on identities and names for ourselves and gender monikers and everything, pronouns. But it was also like our friends were still dying. I mean, or very sick in the hospital or, you know, from AIDS and also later from other things like addiction and things. But so it was, you know, it was a very intense and uniting time. You know, I met with an old friend of ours, Sarah Flicker, who lived there at that time. And just in New York, we hadn't seen each other in years. And I just sat there going, wow, you know, taking care of our friends as they were passing, or all of a sudden not being able to get to see our friends because the parents would block them from us because they were against gay stuff or that their kid was queer. But at the same time, like a lot of creation, making photography, performative photography, drag, you know, music festivals like the Dirty Bird Festival was huge. It was the first place I encountered also like space just for BIPOC people. At the time they said people of color, and like it was a whole learning thing. So it's like, why is that important? And because a lot of our, it wasn't just a white scene, you know, at all. Like it was a very, especially the forward thinking, like more radical element, not radical, but radical, or just, yeah, in a lot of the visionaries were people of color or BIPOC people involved in different kinds of activisms and also punk. So it was, yeah, it was everything. It was like we had these cheap places we could live together in community, and we could be in one region together. But, you know, there was also the tough stuff going on.
Yeah. And so, you know.
And I did lose my uncle to AIDS in 1988. My uncle's partner, who was, we called Aunt Steve, but my Uncle Steve, they had been together since the late 60s. They were part of the movement with Harvey Milk. They had the first gay bookstore in the Castro. It was called Paperback Traffic. And that's also, they had a salon there and all this stuff. And it was open, I think, for like 11 years. And so it's like where people like Armistead Maupin did their first reading, like a lot, and the women's movement, a lot of stuff going on. And then it closed the doors. And I think it was 81, 82. The entire Castro was shuttered down. So I was a kid, you know, maybe 8 or 9. And then, I definitely grew up with like my parents' friends and my family dying of AIDS. So it wasn't. And then, you know, now it's like 10 years later, it's early 90s, back in San Francisco. And it was, you know, when I say about like the atmosphere, that was definitely a huge part of what had just happened and was still happening until the medications changed around 94, 95, where people started living long, you know, longer.
Yeah. And now
there's it's a lot like for that. Kids to deal with, you know?
Yeah, I know. It's like, it's so sad too, because that, like, it's almost like miracle drugs have shown up in the last, you know, couple of decades. And that goes for other chronic illnesses as well. Hep C, you know, and it's, right. And I actually went through Hep C treatment, about a year and a half ago, and had I been diagnosed, and I'd had it for 22 years and I didn't know it, you know? And so, and now it's like a 12-week pill and you're done and it's gone. And, you know, and I like, San Francisco especially was hit hard by Hep C for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And because it was such an injection, you know, drug sort of capital of the U.S. for many years, and people just didn't know, you know? I mean, it got a little better when people became more aware of you know, AIDS, but Hep C continued to sort of, you know, just ravage the addict community for many, many years. And, you know, I just, you know, it's interesting because we did, when I was in Engage especially, we did a lot of work with ACT UP and you know, because we were on that more like, you know, direct action kind of course in terms of our, just our politics. And, you know, I think it's informed everything I've done since. And that's kind of where I wanted to lead this kind of filibuster that I'm doing right now is, you know, you've spent your entire life since that age in different forms of activism, concentrating on many of the same topics, but like really able to adjust your sort of how you're educating people, because you're a teacher as well, and how you bring your message to the times. And, you know, I think it's a really good reflection of growing up in the punk community and queer community of the 80s and 90s. And, you know, maybe just talk a little bit about some of the stuff you're doing now, because our time runs really fast. We're already at a half an hour, and I want
to—I
really want to hear about, because where you're at right now. When I reread your bio this morning, it's so exciting. Like, you're doing such amazing stuff.
And don't forget, Kevin, the last half hour of the show is just to talk about that one basement show in Santa Rosa.
Well, just to clarify, I'm not a teacher, but I do feel like I teach, and I am teachable. So, and you know, I'm in an MFA program. So I guess just basically I decided to, I guess my life has just not been on the linear track, like what was tracked to do in this amount of time. You're supposed to be here, there, whatever. I just basically stepped off of that with my punk friends and kind of built a life that was somehow a different track. So that meant that I went back to school in my mid-40s to go to art school, because I never really got that chance, because I was just working and working as an artist and a musician pretty immediately. And so I was always learning, like, you know, all the free school stuff and going to panel discussions and reading and taking classes at the community college and stuff. And that's always continued. But it's been really great to be in this program that I'm in. And to
has it living, is it nice to find structure that you didn't have before?
Yeah, and mostly just to be in community. So the program I'm in is really special in that it's a public academy. There's no time limit on it. There's all different kinds of people and different ages of people in the program. So it's not just young people. And it's also very diverse. I mean, diversity politics is problematic, but basically there's people from different class backgrounds and different countries. Also the Global South in my class. So my cohort, it's pretty queer. It's very queer, very trans, and very, but not only, you know, it's all different kinds of people. And it's just exciting. It's basically reminiscent of how I, like you said, I just feel like I've always been involved. I mean, I don't call myself an activist, because even though I am very politically engaged, because I just have such respect for people who really are on the front lines, but I definitely am affiliated with and deeply aligned with different social justice movements. And I just feel like I keep learning. And so that's that, like, the kid side of me that I think that punk always showed me, and having elders like the Subhumans guys and stuff, like, or just all different kinds of queer people, or Vaginal Cream Davis, or different people you could look to and go, okay, I can keep being playful. And it can be serious play. Like, it can be like, along with my beliefs of collectivism, you know, I mean, it's not easy to live in collectives, and I don't always, but I have spent many years of my life living and working collectively in terms of creating art and all these things. And so today I'm into that. I played this TV. I was on this TV show, which for a lot of my punk friends at the time in 2005, when I was cast on this show, were like, you're what? Like, they didn't even have TVs, you know, it was before the streaming thing really took place. For them, it just seemed like a bizarre turn of fate. Yeah. And for me, I also, because I didn't also have a TV at the time, and I hadn't for 15 years, you know, since I was a kid. But it ends up that it was quite an intervention in terms of bringing this example of, I played the first trans masculine character on TV recurring. And so what that means is, now there's people who at the time were literally children or young teenagers, and my face is the first representation of transness, a trans mask person who they could possibly be or recognize in their
everything else was like satirical and making fun or over the top or
I mean it was problematic how it was written as well, but I will just say that I really made the effort, which is something I talked with Candace Hansen about in this LA Times article, who's a punk rock drummer and drums with Alice Bags, and everything was just like, I really was trying to put gestures inside of there from our queer and punk scenes, you know, in terms of, and how I spoke in articles, but also what if I could put things on the wall of the character or anything, it felt like I could instill these secret messages from our scene, basically from our punk and radical kind of community. Like, for me, queerness will always be radical. I guess that's the way to say it. So I'm having a lot of fun just like making music, making art, you know, fine art, as they say, and then I got to revise that character. So,
yeah, you know, that was the thing. And so you guys probably saw Taylor come in and leave really quick. Her and her mom are a huge fan of that show. Like, they, so when I told her that you were coming on the podcast, you know, so she tried to be stealth just now, but I know
I saw that
the delivery time was well planned. I know. I'll ever come back when we wrap, but, I will say, that when I say, you know, teacher, I mean that in a broader sense. And I guess I should have clarified it when I said it. When you're able to use a platform as large as like the L Word, which is a, you know, I mean, that show was a huge deal. I don't want to undervalue that show. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right. And I love that article in the LA Times. I think they missed the mark on your character in many ways the first time around. And I'm not a critic, and I'm certainly not, you know, it's not my job to tell people how to write shows. I mean, but it's so great that they brought you back to sort of like to really kind of like reintroduce this character in a much better voice, and in one that I think represents hopefully you a little bit more in your experience, because it's such an important topic. And people, and this is something that I've learned doing the other show that I mentioned before we started recording, is that people have this innate ability somehow, because of our overwhelmed society, to dehumanize others. And we don't get to hear these stories in a way that is really the most important thing that I've learned is connection. And so when you talk about living in a collective and you talk about these characters that you've been able to play, and the playing in bands and bringing a message of like, this is who I am, to a broader public, it's so important, because we get the chance to say, oh, that's another human being. That's another person, rather than just like dehumanize this whole, you know, life that we live. And so I just wanted to like call that out. Like, that character is like really important. Like, I really want to make that clear to people that listen to our show. Like, it was a huge deal at that time. It just wasn't happening in Hollywood, you know? So and thank you for doing it. I mean, it informed probably a lot of people out there.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it always felt like a privilege to do it. Knowing how my elders had lived and how many of my contemporaries, like, to be able to do that, it did feel, and it was like, it felt like a real privilege, and I tried my best to do the best I could do. But I think it's more evident to me now what a huge deal it is, because I meet these guys who are now in their 30s, who or people, they don't have to be necessarily trans masc, but definitely meeting a lot of men now who say that I'm the face of what they saw as their first possibility to be themselves. I mean, that's just an honor. And actually, like I always say, it doesn't really have much to do with me. It has to do with an identity, an idea, a possibility. And that's, again, the punk thing, why I always come back to punk rock, because for me, it was exactly that. It's about positivity and connection and possibility, you know, instead of just this nihilistic thing of like, fuck everything. It's like, you know what? It's fucked up world. Let's try to make something together. You know, hey, I work at the bagel shop. I'll bring some bagels to the show. Someone else, like, you know, my other best friend besides Miriam is Aaron Elliott, who wrote the Compass fanzine, and that fanzine and his way of life, it's like, it really exemplified to me like what's possible in all these years. He always has been that to me, and many other contemporaries.
That's very astute. That's very similar, you know? Right? Because for me, as someone, I've only had representation, right? Like my whole life, I've looked on TV and seen me. But then I grew up in the burbs. And for me, Comet Bus was like, oh, I can do this stuff. I can do this. I can do that. I can start a band. I can go hitchhike. I can do all this stuff. It opened up a world for me that I did not know existed, and kind of allowed me to kind of do things that were outside of my own social norms, you know?
Yeah.
It was representation of something. It was the same way like reading On the Road or something, I think.
Yeah.
I don't have any another way to like exemplify what that's like for me, but
it's like those zines that Kathleen sent me. I mean, it's just all these examples of like, how can we exemplify that it's possible to be yourself and to be cherished and loved and adored and encouraged. Like, that's what I want to do always with whatever I'm making.
You are, so, you did.
So it's cool to see it, to get this chance to go back and revise this character, even in a small gesture, like one episode, and go, okay, well, if I'm going to do that, these are they asked me, what things would you need to put in place? And I went right back to my DIY ways. And I was like, well, I would like to have some say in the story itself, and who would be a partner, and how would it look? You know, and they really gave me some of that room to do that. And I wouldn't have been so bold if I hadn't had years of experience with my punk friends of just realizing that a small possibility, like a tour around the U.S. is actually a huge possibility, you know, in terms of liberation. I mean, because we're talking about liberation, I guess that's why I get so excited about it all, because I mean, I'm always learning more. I do identify as a white settler. Like, I'm a descendant of white settling people of European descent. I have a lot to still unravel and work on in regards to all of that. It's an ongoing process, but we can do it all with like encouragement and kind of gentleness and kindness, like, and be bold, you know. You know, there's a lot more to work on, I guess.
Well, I mean,
think, Sorry, go ahead, Kevin. Joshua.
Go ahead, Pepper.
Do you think, Daniel, that you wanted to have a life that has all these different things in it and you pursued them? Or do you think you're someone that's open to doors and you see opportunities and you're just open to them? Like, did you want to be an actor, or did that opportunity just present itself and you were open enough to it that you were like, sure?
Yeah. You know, I think it's a little of everything, you know. Adulting well is like, I started learning when I was 23 to like eat well and like exercise and do things in a certain way, with the idea of being less, you know, not having health insurance and all this stuff. And like, you know, I guess just trying to find opportunity where there could be, but I never was like, I'm going to be an actor. Although I was in theater in Oakland at Laney College, like 10 years before that. But it's just that there weren't any roles for people like me. And that's where I met my other friend who brought me to Gilman, which is my friend Sarah, who was in my theater class. I was like, oh, there's the other punk, you know. And I asked her where she goes to shows and things. And so, I think, well, more recently, and I haven't talked about it publicly that much, but I think in the punk scene, it's okay. It's good. I mean, I think it's good to bring it out, is that I've been recently diagnosed with adult ADHD, which would have been cool to know about beforehand, but it's been really liberatory because I've realized that so many of the ways that I am as a neurodiverse person comes to this kind of, just thinking outside the box. Like, I didn't really understand what the program was supposed to be. And so I was just kind of doing what seemed like the right thing. I guess it's been not the most linear trajectory, but yeah, the acting thing, it came my way. The confluence of events, and I just try to make the most of it. But then when I got the job for 1 year, I hired my own publicist, who's a punk rock publicist for music bands. And I go, let's, because they didn't realize that it was important. Let's see if people want to hear the story. And so from that is why I got more years on the show. So it was still that DIY attitude and still going back to our community and of also people who think outside the box to, you know, change the culture basically, and intervene and infect the culture, you know?
Yeah. That's amazing. I was thinking about, like, it's really interesting. You mentioned Aaron, and I had some interactions with him recently, because of a t-shirt, job that needed to get printed.
The Pinhead Gunpowder ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. he gave me one.
Good.
I don't know if you ended up doing them, but
I did.
Yeah, and they're great. I almost wore it to the interview, but I
think it's really.
Hey, well, Kevin, I don't have a Pinhead Gunpowder shirt. What the?
Steve at 1234Go Records has all of them, but I can go pick one up.
It's all right.
I've got a couple samples here in my drawer right behind me.
They're great. It's like a great t-shirt.
Well, the interesting thing with him, and I find this, and this is something I'm bad at, so I really love it in other people and I aspire to it, is he would be like, I'd say, okay, we have a digital press check at this time. And he's like, I'll be online for these hours and then I'm off. And he's like serious. Like, if he's going to be offline starting at 6 o'clock, he will not email me back. He's done for the weekend. You know, it's so great though. Like, I so respect it on so
all
many
in,
levels.
You know what I mean?
It's like, it's something I aspire. It was ridiculously frustrating as we're trying to dial in this really complicated print job, but it also was like, so I was so impressed. Like, I was like, I'm jealous. Like, I want to have a disconnected life when I feel like it.
You? Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's exactly what we were talking about before, about being on the road together in these precious moments, you know, to really like recognize like what, I mean, we all have different needs, but I do love that about Aaron and some other people I know who aren't just going along with the program. You know, they're trying to think like, how, I don't want to paraphrase for him, but basically I learned a lot from him about all this stuff over the years. And just as like another friend who you see, oh, he's not necessarily going along with this thing. He's going to keep this space for his creativity, you know, because as an artist or a writer, we have to protect it like a jealous, like, almost like, this is my, I mean, you cannot break into this thing, because the world will want to break in, you know, with all of this, especially nowadays with all these apps and everything. Speaking of.
Sorry.
Is that Aaron?
Yeah. No.
Let's get him on.
No.
All
right. So, yeah, I don't know if we covered all the things, but. I mean, yeah, I think we did.
This is an amazing show.
We're coming up on time, but I really just appreciate this. Just felt like such an organic conversation. This is what we love about this show. Like, I usually have a couple things jotted down, but it always ends up that we just talk about whatever comes up. And
yeah,
I just really appreciate your time. It's super, like, honestly, just it not only took me back to a time that I love, but it really is inspiring. So, because the right here, right now is also incredibly inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because, you know, I can be as sentimental as the next person, but to me, it's all about, like, it is that metaverse thing. Like, to me, time is not linear. It's all happening at the same time. So when I was at that Jawbreaker show, I was with Miriam Kleinstahl.
Yep.
And we were in the pit and some of her students were there in there. And then we were all singing along. And I thought, oh my God, I'm standing in the same spot where I was when I was 18 watching them play. And it felt like all the times were existing at the same time. So if some people look at talking about the past as if it's all this kind of just sentimental thing. But when you see someone like AC Thompson, when I hear his interview with you all, and I think of the time when we were in Europe together, we were at the anti-WTO protests, like in Prague in 2000. And then also he stayed with us in we stayed in similar squads or things like that. And then I see the work that he's doing, for example, today of like all of tracking all this anti-fascist work basically
Nazi
continuing.
Hunter.
Yeah. And the same with like Miriam with her teaching or Aaron with his books and his bookstores and on, and you both too, you know? So it's like, I think that's what's exciting is that and it was the promise that we made. I feel like I don't know if I made a different promise than other people, but the way I took it was we were going to promise to not be sellouts and we were going to, do the right thing. And we were not going to become numb. We were not going to become assimilated into the capitalist system that wanted us to just be robots. And I feel like pretty much all my friends did that. And then now they're out there in the world, like with kids or with doing all different kinds of activisms or art. And like, I just hope that I'm continuing that as well. You know, I hope to be able to act in a bunch of different stuff now that the world's less transphobic.
Sure.
In some ways, we were waiting, us 90s, queer people, we would never have imagined this moment, but when we were making up pronouns, like, what should we do? Hi, like, Zeezer, hi, he, him, they, them, like, we never thought they'd be like putting it in, like, you know, at Harvard, whatever, on their applications or.
I'll come back.
It's Taylor.
You know, we never thought that it would be legitimate in the mainstream. I certainly didn't. I thought we were playing. We were just doing our alternative community stuff. And now look, you know, there's kids growing up with all this possibility. And it's this playful nature. It's like serious play, you know. And
the needle wouldn't have moved without you. Yeah. The needle wouldn't have moved without you. You know what I mean?
But like, also without punk. It's like it's all intertwined. Exactly. It's these movements. I was talking to Boff Wally from Chumbawamba and his partner, Casey, who's a great friend of mine, Casey Orr. And they were talking – he was talking about the links between like some performance group he saw in his youth in Northern England and like Bread and Puppet in Vermont. And then later the stuff they were doing and like how that affected me to see Chumbawamba. And then, so all these ideas are like cross-pollinating and beautiful, I feel. And of course, like, you know, that I've just mentioned a few, but I do think we're continuing in a good way and I'm glad to be able to be on this podcast.
I'm so glad you came on. It's so inspiring. It. You know,
we were so excited. I mean, we had such a good time with Miriam too. Oh, I so desperately want, and then Aaron doesn't do any of this stuff, but I'm just like, I'm trying to figure out a way.
Once in a while.
Get him to come talk a little bit.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like, I just, this has just been great. We've had a really good couple of weeks on the show and, you know, we talked to Jay Robbins yesterday and, it's just been really inspiring.
So inspiring. And thank you so much for coming on. We are coming up on time, Kevin.
Yep.
Yeah.
I want to thank everyone for listening. Tune in next week. There'll be another show. Daniel, of course, this has been amazing. We didn't have time to talk about the only thing that mattered, which was the Thorns of Life show in the basement. But we'll have to get you back on and have a show just about that because it was insane.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's been a great, like I said, it's been a great time. Thanks for including me in this, and may it go down in history that I am an East Bay punk and a queer, SF queer punk forever.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Some streets are highways. I'll get you home. The roads that I take, I roll the groan. It might take me my whole life, but at least I did it right.